Accession number 9420, Reel 6.
Bill Gilman, Reel 6. You were talking about the parcels that you got while you were in the front line. Could you tell me what would be in them? What sort of food?
Yes, well, we usually had the homemade cake, and which the mothers used to make, or the relatives, and also tobacco and cigarettes, according to what they knew their relatives used. And also notepaper and envelopes, which were always useful. Sometimes they'd put a pen or pencil in. It was very well thought out, but of course things weren't all that plentiful at home, and we didn't expect a lot from them, and sometimes we were very surprised at the way the parcels arrived, and that they hadn't been smashed or broken open. In some cases they were, and we found some, according to the letters we got separate from the parcels, we knew that by what was in the letters that some of the parcels had been interfered with on transit. We didn't argue about it because there was nothing you could do about it, you see. It's just one of those things that life's all about. And in the main, the postal service was very good, considering the conditions.
Would you share the contents of the parcels?
Yes, rather, yes. We always, that was the true comradeship, you know, in the whole business, and that what amuses me sometimes, and the political sense of people using the word comrade now when they don't know the meaning of it. And the only comradeship I ever knew was in the trenches, and when we shared everything we had with each other. Even a cigarette, if there was cigarette short on one side and there was only one packet available among the platoon of us, and about 17, 15 or 16, all depends on the size. If there was a little party together in the main, that was what it consisted of in the trenches, little parties. There was five of us. We had a glee party because we all had different voices. I used to sing bass, and we had a lovely bloke from an Irish boy from Galway. He was a smasher. Lovely black hair, curly hair he had, looking black, and he got a beautiful tenor voice, and he used to sing Mary. That was his favourite, you know, and he come from Galway, and he was very proud of it. He used to tell us what it was like, you know, in the mountains. He lived in the mountain region, apparently, and we were great pals. He got killed, though, unfortunately. It was just the only thing that affected me mostly was when you had pals and you'd built up a little comradeship, one of us got knocked out, or a couple of us, and then that was when we felt the war was really hitting us, you know. It wasn't what the Germans were doing to us generally, or we were doing to the Germans. If our mates, we lost our mates that was together, this is what I'm speaking personally as it affected me, and I think it was the same with all of us. And to that extent, you know, the pace was so fast from the time I went up in the front line and started in these various actions, you didn't get time to establish a very long relationship. It was only afterwards, when the war was finished and I went in the trade crew company, that we kept people together, and then we were people from all regiments. That's a different story, though. But generally speaking, while we were together in the trenches, we were one solid comradeship. You know, we relied on one another, and if there was anything we knew that it was going to make for our safety, like a particular place where we went up the line or anything like that, and we'd been tipped off any one of us, we'd pass it on immediately, and it became a general sense of security.
What about letters? Would you write home while you were in the line?
Yes. Yes, that was when we used to do it, in the dugouts. We used to write letters in the dugouts. And, because as soon as you got out of the line, you went into training. You hadn't got much time for writing, except in the evening, of course, or then you wanted to go to the NAFI or something like that, if there was one. And there usually was.
What sort of thing would you write about while you're in the line? We've got two of your letters.
Well, it's just as I put in my letters, which you could read into the tape if you wanted to, you know, because...
Well, they're in the file, so...
Yes, well, there's nothing much I can add to that except the narrow escapes, as I mentioned in my letter once, when in Chapelle Ridge there, where there was hardly any of us left, no officers, and the highest rank was Sergeant Major Cook of A Company, who they thought could never get killed, and yet he got it through the neck. He was a DCM and bar. And he was the highest rank left after that.
So you'd write about that sort of incident. And would you tell them about the general conditions in the trench?
No. No, because it was censored anyway. It would have been scrubbed out, I think. Because they didn't want to. They wanted to keep the morale up at home. You don't do things that they're going to frighten people, although there may not have been much in it, so far as we were concerned. But... The general thing was that if you could get away with it, you put it in, you know, you thought you, same as I said, that I'd be, rifle, a sling had been cut in two with a bullet. I mean, that was when we were wiped out and I jumped for a shell hole.
Yeah. And we'll come to that. What about getting back to the supply? What about things like your ammunition and your equipment and maintenance of uniforms, you know, any spare clothes? Did you get that?
No spare clothes at all. We had no spare clothes at all. The conditions were such that it was a hard life then, and it was part of the war, and you'd never know when you were going to move. On the other hand, the lice, there was a lot of lice there. And when you got settled down there and you were living for weeks without, you know, washing or getting a bath...
What happens if you tore your uniform or it ripped? Would you get it replaced?
I don't know. I never had that happen to me. I mean, I couldn't answer for what sort of emergency there was and how it was treated as far as uniforms were concerned, but... I never had any reason to, and I was pretty big too, as I am now, and I never had any bad luck, you might say, with my clothes.
What about ammunition? How did that come up?
Ammunition was always brought up, made sure that we had sufficient. Sergeant Major, and of course Sergeant used to report that back. And there was always a replenishment after an action. You had to. Of course, soon after that, I took up the Lewis gun. I became number one gunner. And then, of course, your own 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 on the gun always had the panniers. They were the ones responsible for ammunition for some of us.
Looking now at the sort of sanitary arrangement, so to speak, did you have any opportunity to wash or shave in the front line, or would you want to?
Well, you had to, but you had to use the water you had. And, of course, you weren't allowed to use the water in your water bottles, but we did use some of it, obviously. But sometimes we used to wash up and shave in the same water, and you had to make do. It was under wartime conditions, and it's as simple as that. Nobody knows what a human being can do until they're put to the test, and then...
Did you have to shave? Did they enforce shaving? Or was it left to you while you were in the
line? Everybody shaved. There was nobody that I remember had any beards that time. It wasn't accepted at all.
But in the line, would people still make the effort to shave?
Oh, yes. Yes. And, of course, they were naked razors, you know, the what they used to call the cutthroat razors. You know, open razors then, and no such thing as safety razors in those days.
What about the latrines? What arrangements
Well, you did the best as you could with the conditions. They were already there if you went into it, took over a trench, and they were situated out in no man's land as a rule. And if it was possible to disguise them, you did. If it was a question of part of a trench, you know, that was an off cut. But you just had to take your chance there.
What arrangement did they actually have?
Well, just a canvas set up, you know, if it was above ground. And they got knocked out as a rule, you know, very often, and replaced. And this was all part of the living conditions. It was primitive. You had to do the best you could and where you could and how you could.
Did they provide you with paper or anything like that?
No, you had to make do the best you could, you know. There's no such thing as toilet rolls and newspaper, old newspapers, or wrappings from the parcels and all that kind of thing. Were always used. It was needs must when the devil drives sort of business.
How did you go about disposing of just the waste of trench life, things like old tin cans and things like that?
Well, normally, you see, very often you had a lot of places in the trench system where trenches came to a dead end, and they were part sometimes of a communication trench that led into onto other trenches to continue the line, but they were filled with barbed wire because they were either dangerous or not deep enough. And then, of course, the usual thing happened, you slung your cans onto the barbed wire. And, of course, you got the inevitable result. The bloody rats used to seek out the tins because they could smell the food in them and that. And that used to cause a bit of alarm sometimes when they rattled the wire of a night time. You see, you might think it was a Jerry's on patrol or something like that.
Did you get many rats?
Not a lot, no. It all depends on if you were static in the trenches for some time and you'd had bad weather, and that's when you found them, because they'd get more daring then, you know, and also self-preservation, even rats adopt. And I've seen them in the trenches running about in the bottom of the trench. We'll be lying down in the bottom of the trench. There'd be no dugout there, when that was the only thing you could do, lie down the bottom of the trench if you wanted to do 40 winks or something of that, which is all about all it was when you had two on and four off. Although 4 hours sounds a long time, it's not very long, but you went off. You were so tired sometimes.
But did the rats frighten you at all, or disgust you?
No. It was all part of the setup. You know, you expected things like that.
Did they steal any? Did they take any of the food you'd have? Did you have to watch out for that?
Yes. Well, you always made sure you covered. You put everything that was eatable inside your mess tin and shut the lid down, and that was all right. There was no bother like that. They were very well made, the mess tins. I thought the equipment was good and, you know, made to conform to purposes like that. It was not an ordinary living.
What about lice? You mentioned it earlier.
I burnt lice off the seams of my tunic. They were there, you know, and my favourite way was burning them. And they used to dig out, some of them used to rake them out, and I didn't think that was very good because they were still alive and you had to kill the bloody things, you know, and seams used to be the favourite haunt of the, and in the tunics where most of the lice were, and you got them in your trousers sometimes, but you always made sure it was, you know, you kept yourself as clean as possible. You had no killing spirit or, you know, disinfectant or anything like that to deal with them. And you just had to make the best of it. It was just hard luck if you'd been in the static conditions for a long time. When you got out the line, you had to delice yourself there sometimes when you got out.
What do you mean by that? How would you do that?
Well, as I say, burn them out.
You wouldn't get a bath and your clothes you know.
I think on two rare occasions there were disinfestation places where you could get your clothes disinfected, you know. But I can't remember where they were but I remember on two occasions that things were bad because everybody was coming out with lice in their clothes, and it became the best way of dealing with them. They were put in some sort of oven or something, and or burned out or something. I don't know what they did with them, but they used to come back fairly clear anyway.
So most people had this problem, did they?
Yes. Anybody was in the line for any length of time did it, because we never used to change the clothes, you see. We hadn't got anything to change to.
Were there any other pests around, you know, animal life,
no.
Small or large?
No.
What about dead bodies in the ground and
above? I never came across dead bodies as such, only skeletons and as I say, Aussie hats. Run across a fair number of those and lying about in no man's land when we were advancing. That's when I saw them. That's where it was. I knew they were Australians because those brimmed hats, you know, with the hat side turned up.
What about when you were on the old battlefield?
That was where we saw them.
So any new dead bodies would be taken back and buried away from the line?
Oh, yes, I think they were disposed, or else they were picked clean by birds or rats or something, and if they hadn't been buried or anything like that. It was clear that there had been battlefield previously there. It was an old battlefield because the number of shell holes all over the place and the rugged nature of the ground with the trees all bare and splintered and stumpy.
Did the weather affect you much? The cold weather, wet weather?
No, well, fortunately, you had your pack, you see. You had your overcoat. And you had to wear your overcoat sometimes when it was perishing cold in the winter. I mean, the time I was there, we had some very severe cold there. And it was, of course, we had gloves issue as well. And you kept yourself warm as best you could by slapping your hands together or, you know, humping yourself up. Or when you come off stand to, you got in the old dugout and all got close together and kept one another warm.
What about the wet conditions?
Well, you put up with it. It's as easy as that. You know, you couldn't do anything about it. You can't stop rain. And it was just like that. You dodged it as far as you could. But tin hats kept a little bit off your head, obviously, but then you got it on your shoulders, so...
Did you get any cases of frostbite or trench feet from the colder water?
No.
What about trench fever? Did you ever come across that?
No.
When you had dysentery, how bad were you with it?
I was sent to hospital. I went to hospital for a fortnight.
How did they treat you?
All right. It was good. I went well out of the line. I couldn't even hear the guns. And I had a great time in hospital because I joined I didn't join the concert party, but I used to help with the stage props and all that when I was, you know, getting better. Because when you get dysentery, it only catches you at awkward moments. And you've got to chase about a bit then. But other than that, and I remember Stanley Broughton and Forbes Robinson, or Robertson, was prominent actors and actresses, you know, in the among ends, so they were giving shows down in the hospital area where I was, because they used to give it to the wounded soldiers and all that, you know. And of course they were wounded there in the same hospital. I mean, I was only one of the minor casualties, because as soon as the dysentery was over, back I went to the front line again. But I enjoyed myself for that fortnight.
Other than that, what was your health like, basically, while you were...
My health? Good. Oh, I was lucky, same as I've always been all my life, you know, I've been dead lucky. That was the only thing I had. And as my record shows, you know, I was dead lucky right the way. I was one of God's chosen, I reckon.
Now go through some of the things of daily routine and that sort of thing. Can we start with stand two? Did you have a stand two in the morning or in the evening?
Yes, no, morning. Half an hour before sunrise and half an hour before sunset.
What would you
used to be the general, stand to on the fire step with your rifle or your machine gun later on through. When I became a Lewis gunner, first class Lewis gunner, because I could strip. I was very good at stripping down and assembling guns and that. And then we had those on the trenches, and you just stood to and you peered over the top. I've opened fire in the early morning stand too, at some bushes that were waving about in the mist, and they looked like Jerry's moving about, you know. And in fact, sergeant come up to me and said, "Who the bloody hell was that firing?" And so I said, "It was me, sergeant." So he said, "What are you firing at?" I said, "I could see something over there." I said, and he had a look over the top. He said, "Oh, Christ." He said, "That's bushes there. It's been there all the time. Did you know that?" And so we had a laugh about it. But anyway, of course, I suppose Jerry fired back. I can't remember now, because if you fired, they fired back. It was just like that.
When you say you looked over the top, did you use periscopes or anything, or did you...
Oh, no, you look over the top. Oh, yes. You could hear Germans talking there sometimes, you know. We were that near in the front line. But, I mean, I got... it was in the reserve line when I was in the second line on one occasion. I got knocked off for singing in the front line, because I was a bit go lucky, you know, and I didn't care. And we had a battery of field artillery on our right. The horses had drawn the guns up, turned them round, and they were firing on our right. And yet I was knocked off for 3 days CB for singing in the front line. And when I came up on charge after we come out the line, I don't know whether you want me to hear about this, but the officer who was defending me was asked by the officer in charge of the inquiry that, what have you got to say in Gilman's defence? And he said, "Cheerful under all circumstances, sir." And in spite of that, I got 3 days CB. I suppose they had to give me something, but it wasn't a crime in army records. It's never recorded, 3 days CB. You go and peel potatoes instead of... being loud time orphans.
Why were they so annoyed that you were singing? This was because the Germans would hear you. And
well, the charge was that I was revealing my presence to the enemy, and there was a battery of guns on the right firing at them. You know, that's why I mentioned that too in my answer when I said, they said, "Have you got anything to say?" And I told them. And they said, "That doesn't alter the fact you were making noise and revealing your presence." You know, they would have it their way.
Now, what would you, after stand to, what would you do then?
Well, we stand to until it was half an hour after sunrise and sun, you know, or an hour. All depends on the type of sky, you know, whether it was overcast or it was bright. If it was nice and bright and clear and all that, okay, you stood down and then you would take your relief. You were taken over, or you finished your turn of duty. But you had to alter that, because otherwise you'd get your duties mixed up. You see, you couldn't all stand to at the same time. But most of you did, because that's when you had to watch out. If there was a patrol or an attack going over from the enemy, then you've got to be ready for it. And that was the time they used to attack, patrols and otherwise. And very often they'd attack without any gun, preliminary barrage. And they used to belt us sometimes with the barrages.
What would you normally do then, once you'd stood down?
Just simply get in your dugout. That's all you could do. There's nothing. You couldn't leave your trenches, obviously.
So what would you do during the day? Would you have breakfast, or...?
Well, if it was meal time, or there was rations came up or anything like that, then you acted accordingly, you know. And otherwise you got the trenches in the dugout rather, and had a smoke and a yarn and or a song. You didn't care. It was happy-go-lucky life, really. You just accept it, because there's nothing you do. And especially the old songs used to reflect that by saying, "I want to go home," you know, and all this, the old We all did it in fun, even when we were on the march. We had two bands with us. We had a pipe band of eight pipers, and we had a brass band, because it was always said that the brass band only knew one tune and couldn't play anything else. But they used to go, and that was the one they always played, you know, when they broke up. But we could march miles behind the pipers, twice as far as what we could march behind when the brass band was playing. And even if they carried on playing the same tune, they only varied it very little, but that was the main tune. They didn't even play Colonel Bogey, which was ones we liked. We used to sing that when the band stopped. But the pipers were great, we had with us. Out the line, of course.
So, in the you weren't given anything official to do during the day then? You didn't do any sort of minor trench repairs or anything like that?
No. Engineer's job, that was. Any repairing business or anything like that. I mean, we had no tools to do repairs to trenches or anything like that, you see. I mean, there was nothing we could do. Most of the wire repair stuff had to be done night time because it wasn't...
So during the day, you were left completely on your own, were you, to do what you liked?
There was nothing else you could do.
What sort of thing... You used to do this singing...
We used to have a glee party in the dugout, you know, get together. There was just five of us. I mean, I can't answer for the other blokes, but, you know, the only contact we had outside of our little party, a crowd that we, five of us, I remember, were special because we could all sing. I think that was a real thing that attracted, kept us together more than anything. And it was just like that. I mean, you'd stick together and you'd consult, and if you got in general conversation...
What sort of things would you talk about?
Home and, you know, the girlfriends and, you know, the relatives and all this kind of thing. And speculate about how long the war was going to last and all this. Generally feeling it, there was no despondency there, you know. This is what amazed me about it all. They sent the old British Tommy, you know, and it's true. You know, it's unconquerable, really. It just can't... It's not understandable at all, really, because it doesn't seem natural for people under those conditions to accept things like they did. But, of course, I think it was the same in the German army. I think they accepted the position the same way. I don't think it was just because we were British, but... We always have had a knack for standing up best when we got our back to the wall, sort of, and we were suffering a lot of people and from the casualties.
Would you have meal times during the day at set times, or would you just eat when you wanted? Were the rations just given to you and you ate when you wanted?
Oh, no, you had it when rations came up. You only had it when rations came up.
When would they come up?
Mind you could nibble away at chocolate or decide to have a bit of cake if there was any left if you felt peckish or anything like that. But other than that, they'd come up when they were able. Sometimes a barrage would stop a supplies coming up. I mean, it was war conditions. And
when would it usually be, though?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't remember. I mean, it was usual meal times, like breakfast and dinner. Or dinner time, and all depends, you see, because again you've got the question of in the winter time when you heard the early nights closing about 4 o'clock. I mean, it upset you. You couldn't have a meal, say, oh, it's tea break, we can't we can't stay in two, see. So that's how it was. It was under war conditions. You conform to the conditions prevailing.